The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2010 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2010. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Well, good afternoon. It's 3:10 according to my timer up here, and I'm going to assume that's official time. Welcome to this session on school law. And welcome to Durham. I happen to be a resident of Durham, so I feel an obligation to welcome you to my hometown. How many of you are from outside of North Carolina? Okay. I'm the minority. My name is David Hostetler, and I'm the presenter for today. As I said, I live in Durham and practice in Chapel Hill. I'm the director of Lexis School Law Services. It is a small practice that provides legal counsel and training in education law, primarily for educators, public and private, around the state of North Carolina. I have been doing education law for about 16 years now. I started out at the University of North Carolina as the legal director for a statewide leadership program for public school administrators, and have been doing this, as I say, for quite a while. I was blessed to have in one of my sessions a few years ago Larry Stevenson from the Cary Christian School, and Larry contacted me last year about this program and asked me if I might be interested, so I welcome the opportunity to be here. I don't know what to think about this session being assigned to about the last session of the day on a Friday. I was struck by Oz's comment that he shared about speaking after lunch being the art of speaking into somebody's sleep. And I'd like to adapt that and just say that speaking at the end of the day on Friday is probably the art of speaking in somebody's way as you're trying to make towards the doors and get out of here. As the description for this session indicates, we're going to sort of overview some basic legal practices and principles for administrators and board members. How many of you are board members? Okay, are the rest of you administrators, I assume? Anybody else, teachers? Okay, anybody else that I didn't cover? Wife, okay. That's an important role when you're in legal duress. So what I want to do today is present what's in the handout, and hopefully you have the three-page detailed outline, which is really simply an expansion of what was in your notebook. There are some in the back, apparently, if you don't have one. And I want to try and make my way through that. I sometimes don't get through everything. I've tried to put things in the order I want to hit them, and if we miss anything, you have the material there, and you, certainly with any of the things that we cover, I will stick around for as long as necessary to answer any more specific questions that you have, and you're certainly welcome to email me or call me as well after this session, assuming you do want to charge out the door at 4:10. As the overview indicates, my approach with the law as a counselor and as an instructor is at the heart of it to talk about law as a strategic aspect of running and leading a school. And it's more than just basic, how do I stay out of trouble, although that's a legitimate concern. But there are, if you understand the law and you understand it well, or your administrators understand it, there are ways to use it to promote higher order objectives, safety, health, academic success ultimately in an educational institution. And so that's sort of my approach when I go through these materials. We're going to cover, as I say, sort of a potpourri of issues, so I'm hitting surface. I've chosen for breadth rather than depth, and I hope that's not problematic. Yeah, I think there was fair advertising. You knew what you were getting when you came into the session. Let me begin with a brief introduction, and that's to talk about first principles. And I framed it in terms of ends, the end of education or the end of Christian education in this context. And I get that title from Neil Postman's book called The End of Education. How many of you are familiar with that? It's not a Christian book, but it's, I think, a good read. And it's aimed particularly towards public education. And one of his basic themes is that if you examine the discussion about education, the debates, the materials, most often, in a large percentage of cases, the discussion is about the means of education and not about the ends of education, the purpose of education. And he obviously, and I agree with him, that that leads to some real problems and distortions and the undermining of perspective of what institutions and individual leaders are to be about, and you lose a tether if you don't have that clearly in perspective. And that there's an application of that idea to the law as well. And so I want to encourage you to think about the law, again, not just as one means of running a school or staying out of trouble, but a means toward a more important end, which is the academic end, in your case, the spiritual and moral objectives that you have in your schools. So with legal counsel and legal compliance, there is a spiritual and educational and organizational set of standards that we have to take into consideration when making a decision about what to do in the face of a legal crisis or legal issue. And there's a balancing of those objectives. I'm moving on to subpoint C, and with respect to strategic legal compliance, as I've listed there, some of the objectives, some of the means, and some of the motives that are involved in compliance. And I've listed them pretty much in order of basic motive, which is simply to comply with whatever rules govern your schools and keep yourself out of trouble, to, again, pursuing those higher objectives of order, safety, efficiency, and ultimately of academic achievement. And with each of the sections that I'm going to be working through, I've concluded each section with five practical points or questions so that you can come away with from this session with some very practical things. So this is going to be a very practical session, and I invite your questions. I obviously can only limit the amount of time we spend in response so I can try and get through, but feel free as I go through these to raise specific questions if you have them. So if you look at point D, I've laid out there what, from my perspective, are five of the most common or at least merging types of claims that plague both independent and public schools. Breach of contract issues, dealing with fees, disciplinary issues and academics, a complaint of that the school failed to deliver on its promises, negligence involving student injuries most of the time, and negligence suits, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, are particularly prevalent, issues of safety with facilities, your sports programs, extracurriculars, and so forth. Employment disputes, obviously, contractual conflicts, dismissal issues, and some overtime issues, and we're going to, again, get into those. Regulatory issues, failure to comply with state, local, or federal issues. And not surprisingly, the internet and electronics are becoming a dominant field of litigation and conflict in schools. Again, the internet doesn't discriminate between independent schools and public schools and charter schools. And about 10 years ago, I started diving into technology law as it relates to school when it was in its infant stage. And I think I can confidently say now that in the last 2 years, it has become a dominant and distinct topic of education law. And probably now in the last 2 years, the queries from clients coming in, about a quarter to a third of them deal with internet issues, Facebook, safety issues, speech issues. Now, you don't have to worry about free speech in the constitutional sense, but it is emerging. And I don't know if you're sensing that yourself as you're navigating, but I see a lot of heads nodding that it's becoming much more prominent. Okay. Let me focus first on the board members and your duties. This will be brief, and this and some of the other things will obviously be review for many of you. Some of it's common sense, but as we know, whether it's sitting in the pews and listening to a sermon, we have to be reminded of things that we already know. Just the basic duties of board members I've listed here for-profit or non-profit board, you have a basic duty of diligence and reasonable care. You hear the term sometimes due diligence. Well, that relates here. Board members have a duty to act reasonably and responsibly and diligently to carry out their duties. The duty of good faith, in other words, to avoid conflicts of interest and put the interests of the school above individual or personal interest. The duty of obedience, just simply the duty of complying with the law, and that's what makes a session like this particularly relevant. There's a notion called the business judgment rule, and it basically says that if you screw up or you make a decision that turns out in retrospect not to have served the school real well, if you've exercised these other duties, you've acted in good faith, you've acted reasonably, but of course you want to be able to document all of this, and it turns out to be the wrong decision, it's basically an excuse or a protection against a claim for individual liability if it turns out, again, to be harmful to the school. So there's some protection in there. And then the next point, I think it's important to point out the particularly important and unique responsibility of maintaining confidentiality with respect to issues that come before the board that warrant it. That is obviously a common sense principle, but believe me, common sense doesn't always rule the day when in the press of busyness and rush decisions and other things that get in the way. So a reminder to you, ask yourself, are we maintaining that confidence properly? Do we have the procedures in place? And then finally, yes. Yes, it is. I can't give you a long answer. This is a nice distinction between private schools and public schools. You're not subject to public records requirements. So there really is not a legal duty except to the extent you've bound yourself in some other legal way to be transparent. Now, with a lot of issues, the first consideration is what does the law say, but the other consideration is ethically, and for other reasons, what should you do? And because you're in Christian schools and operating with a foundational set of spiritual and moral principles, that's an important consideration. So some boards might say, we don't have to do it, we won't do it. Yeah. Best practices. I can't say I'm aware of an industry standard in private schools. I would say that this is where having legal counsel obviously is helpful to you. But aside from that, I would say that if you're not sure, then don't disclose it. If disclosing promotes some of these other values and the objectives of your school, being transparent, is there any reason not to be transparent? I think it makes sense to be reasonably transparent, and certainly not just to avoid the appearance that you're being secretive, but simply to serve the community objectives of we're all in this together. So I think this is a good example where you should have a policy, because the policy forces you to think through, you know, what those boundaries are. So it's a great question, and it's an example of a question of an issue where the law may give you a wide degree of latitude. And this is part of strategic legal compliance. If the law gives, first knowing that the law gives you a lot of latitude as a private institution, of course, you have to be, there's some Sarbanes-Oxley issues that you have to consider in terms of proper record keeping. But strategically, if you know first that the law gives you a lot of latitude, then you think to yourself strategically, okay, what works best for the school? What's most consistent with our values? If we were in the parent's shoes or the community's shoes, what would make sense? And, you know, is it going to harm us at all to disclose? But again, you need to have policies in place so that there's some consistency and so that everybody's doing things the same way. Okay, let's see, where are we? So that was confidentiality. And the last point is simply one that really encompasses some of the previous points, and that has to do with retaining and relying on outside experts to come in and provide counsel and advice. And again, there's a requirement to act diligently and reasonably in the choices you make when you retain those experts. But once you have, it's just a question of reasonableness in relying on that. And sometimes that takes the pressure off the board if you have that formal opinion. So that's another advantage of retaining, whether it's a lawyer, accountant, or some other professional, to get that advice when you need it. Okay. 2B. The board role in supporting and overseeing school administrators. This is another issue of, in a sense, best practices. There really isn't, for the most part, laws that say you can't step in as board members and be involved in a decision, or that the head can't step in and play a role in policy making, except to the extent that your charter, your bylaws, would provide clear boundaries. So you really, again, have wide latitude here. And I assume that many of you have heard talks on effective board practices that discuss the importance of knowing your roles and making sure you have clear and defined duties for board members and responsibilities, primarily for policy matters and general oversight of the administration of the school, and that's where it stops. And you probably are aware of boards that either abdicate that responsibility at one end of the extreme, or go to the other extreme and step in and interfere with the administration of the school. So this is less a legal principle and more of what's most effective in terms of smooth operations. Sermon I heard last week, the minister made a point about, he was talking about spiritual gifts and knowing your gifts and knowing what your gifts are not and knowing your boundaries. And the way he put it, he said, learn to stay in your lane. Don't cross into somebody's lane. And some problems arise, and they can turn into legal problems when, for instance, the board board members start intervening or parents start calling board members about a concern rather than going up the line of command within the administration. And that can create, obviously, some disharmony or some confusion, at least, and inconsistencies. And it's important that your boards discuss this and make sure you're all, in a sense, on the same page about what you do, what you don't do, and you're in the habit as board members of saying, have you gone through the proper channels with the administration and deferring and deflecting and reserving your role as board members for, again, the policy decisions and the review, the major review of executive actions. Yes. Okay, I'll let it slip for the first time. My answer is it depends. Okay, I'll try not to rely on that too often. But what does it depend on? Why can't I answer that right off the top? What would it depend on? The question is whether the head of the school has recourse when board members cross into his or her lane and interfere, or in some other ways violate some standard procedure that affects the head. It would depend from a legal standpoint, not ethics or good practice, but from a legal standpoint, or at least a rule-based standpoint, on one, is there a provision in the head's contract that deals with this? Is there a board policy? And you hate, I don't advise having lots of rules and lots of procedures if they're not essential, but I think that's an issue that probably should be in most contracts with your heads of school, or at least addressed explicitly in some document so that there's something to point to and say that was overstepping. And then some kind of a remedial measure, in most cases, an informal process of just talking it out and working it out between the individuals, and if necessary, having some process for going to the next level and getting review. Okay? Anybody else want to follow up with that? Okay. So stay in your lanes. Know what they are. Have lane markers and road signs so that you're not driving down an unmarked road where you're swerving from side to side. Okay, so five questions, five practical, you might say, takeaways would be, first, and these are in the form of questions, at least in this section, for you to consider. Is your board even reasonably aware of what individual duties and corporate duties it has? Are those clear? Is there a job description, or even some use contracts, at least informal contracts? So is that clear? Is there training? Are there times to go back to that and refresh? Is there orientation? So again, these are common sense points, but often overlooked in the busyness of volunteering as a board member. So it's an important question. The next would be, have your board members read all your important documents as a school? Do they really understand, obviously, the mission values, and then secondarily, the policies? Not that you have to read all of the school board's policies in detail, but at least to review them and to educate and train and discuss on a periodic basis. And I realize, again, that in the press of holding full-time jobs, having families, and the other demands that are upon us, some of these practices don't always happen. It's easy to have it in the rhetoric, but not in the reality. And it's just a reminder, yet, if you're going to assume this, and if you're going to have a fully functioning board, that these are some of the basic things that ought to take place if you're going to reach a state of maturity as a as an organization, to make sure things are running smoothly. The next, do board members have a job description that clearly defines the duties boundaries? I mentioned that already. Next, are you maintaining confidentiality? Do you have some policies in place? If you've had problems, how have you addressed them? And have you been able to resolve that? But again, reminding, even reviewing the confidentiality policy or having the discussion, having that in the minutes, and having other things that involve the training of the board, not just as good for the board, but is also legal documentation that shows some diligence and reasonableness in trying to provide this training if, Lord forbid, there is a lawsuit saying that the board was not adequately trained or the board failed in its duties. And we ask ourselves this in every meeting that we attend, and you always need to keep asking it, are we running efficiently? Are we operating efficiently? Again, you know, are board members being asked to take on responsibilities that really ought to be delegated to the administration? Or vice versa? And how do our board meetings run? And if they're not very smooth, if we spend a lot of time talking about minutia, that's really for the board, you're not using your time well. Your board's not using its time well. So I know I'm telling you things that you already know, but it's important to be reminded of it. And these are just good evaluative questions to take back and perhaps use them as a basis for review and discussion. Okay, move on to contracts. Yes.
Just to return to that question for a minute.
Which one?
Okay.
Yeah.
In the case of the board is advocating responsibilities over to the head of school, say like writing policies in the early stages of the school or something mm-hmm. like that, the board is the head of school is maybe has some more experience in education or something like that. And would you say that it'd be appropriate for the head of school would it be in the best interest of the school for the head of school to kind of give that back, even if the head of school wanted to would like to kind of write that policy and would like that responsibility?
Guess what my first answer is. Anybody want to guess as to what it depends on? Some of what I'm saying is somewhat fluid and flexible because it'll depend on the maturity of the school. How old is it? I mean, in some instances, when you're first starting out, you're just not at the stage where you're operating the way I'm talking about. And that's out of necessity, and that's okay. You do what you have to do. So I would say that if they've turned the policy, now you say they turned it over to the head, well, that can be okay. I think that's probably, in many cases, and it would depend, for the head, really, the administration to be crafting the policies, because they're implementing them, and then presenting them to the board. So it may be good on a long-term basis, and this is where you have to think through as a board that you have to factor in a lot of these first objectives and principles. What kind of school do we want to be? What's the reality in terms of time? Do we only have one administrator who's trying to do everything? And so those are the factors you have to consider. But in an ideal world, or the target, I think, would be with that specific issue, leaving the policies and the detail nuts and bolts for the administration to handle, and then sending it up to the board for review and discussion to give its stamp of approval or to make modifications. I have a feeling we're going to be talking after this session. Yeah, good questions. Keep going.
Before you leave the board session, could you define for us breach and fiduciary responsibility?
Breach of duty is typically a tort type of claim, which meaning it comes out of our common law. It's like negligence. It's a form of negligence. And negligence in whatever sphere, whether it's supervision or negligent hiring, negligence in performing your board duties, breaching your duties, is a highly subjective determination. So I can't give you a crisp formula, an equation that if you plug in the information, you produce negligence or no negligence. It's a standard of reasonableness under the circumstances. So that's why it's a very much it depends kind of situation. So factors that would determine whether there's been a breach of fiduciary duty have to do with, I can think of all kinds of things, but how explicit was the duty? Was it laid out in the job description, in your policies? Is it something that's just common sense, a basic duty of any board member that you're talking about? So what kind of duty are you talking about? How explicit and clear is it? How significant was the breach? Was it a minor breach? Was it a negligible breach? Was it a willful breach? Obviously, if it's a negligent breach of a clearly established duty, then so it's reasonableness. And I know that in my experience, administrators are clamoring for a black and white answer. And I that's about as far as I can go with this and say it's reasonableness under the circumstances. And the courts would say, putting a reasonable person, a reasonable board member who has some level of education and leadership background or some qualifications, you take that reasonable person and put him into that situation. Let's look at the whole picture and determine what a reasonable person would do. So sometimes you have to bring in experts who say, yeah, it's common practice. You have experts on both sides, of course, saying it's common practice that X, Y, and Z would always be done as a basic thing, and B was not done. So I better keep moving on, and if you want to follow up. Okay, where are we? We're moving into employment practices, right? Okay. One of my particular specialties is employment law, along with technology law, and so it's a favorite area for me to kind of emphasize as a prime example how the law is, it can be a strategic tool. There's so many ways that understanding the rules and laws and effective practices in the employment context can foster or radically undermine the effectiveness of a school, whether it's the climate of the school, the morale, the order, the efficiency, and most importantly, the academic success. So it's one of the favorite targets for me to push this idea of strategic compliance. So, simple example. Should our teachers be employed at will, or should they be given one-year contracts? The law says you can do either. You can do whatever you want. Again, this is another advantage of being an independent school. You're not bound by any kind of tenure laws and that type of thing, as long as you don't discriminate and comply with the federal laws and state laws that would govern that. Okay, so here again, the law says you can do what you want. You have the discretion to do it. Now, strategically, what makes the most sense? If we employ, one of my general rules of counsel is to maximize your flexibility as a board and as an employer. Common sense says the more flexibility you have, the more freedom, this is a nice link to Oz's session, the more freedom you have to do to accomplish your mission. It gives you freedom in individual decisions and generally to fulfill those objectives that I first talked about. All right? So why not go with at-will employment all the way around? The law says you can do it, and the law of, does anybody know the rule of employment at will? And it applies in most states. There's some variations from state to state. What is employment at will? don't have to give a reason. The rule is articulated in North Carolina, it's pretty standard, is that the employment relationship is terminable at the will of either party. Works both ways. But guess who normally benefits the most from that? The employer. And the philosophical or policy rationale for that is to maintain maximum freedom, there's that word again, maximum freedom in the workplace to allow that flexibility. So that's the basic rule of employment, I might say, you could say. And everything from that is a variation or exception to that. So why not do that? Why not maximize your flexibility with your employers so that, you know, a teacher starts showing up late on a consistent basis is affecting the classroom, you can say, this is not working out. And responses, why not do that? All right. It works both ways. So you could be stuck scrambling after school starts. That's a practical reason. Anything else? Yeah. Difficult to attract good teachers if they don't have any job security when they come to your school. Anything else? Morale. It may produce a morale problem. Teachers really don't think that their school cares about them, their board cares about them, if this is the way they're going to treat them. Yeah. That, because that would violate another rule, right? So there are exceptions to at will. You can fire for any reason, no reason, or even a moral or unethical reason, which wouldn't happen in a Christian school, right? at least in North Carolina, we have that bad reason. Some states have dismissed that, unless there's an exception. And so don't go away from here thinking, oh, we can just clean house when we go back, because there are protections for people who get pregnant or based on other protected classifications. In the public context, if somebody writes a letter to the editor and then gets fired coincidentally a week later, there's a free speech protection, which you don't have to worry about. Okay. So my main point is these are strategic considerations, but you need to know what the law is. And it's freeing. It's in some ways organizationally liberating to say, well, here's the law. We can do X, Y, and Z. And then decide what's best. Best based on all kinds of considerations, moral, ethical, pragmatic, financial, and so forth. Okay. So I'm point 4A. I point out for your information, just as an interesting tidbit, with respect to this idea of employment law being a core area of strategic compliance, that one thing that's happened here in North Carolina, and it's really happening nationally in the public education context, so again, this is just for information purposes, is what I've observed is an evolution of getting the best teachers and leaders. Really, it's an ethical aspiration and an organizational one. We're always trying to get the best people in place. But we've reached a point nationally, and in North Carolina, a very explicit point, where the courts and the laws have, because of increasing accountability, basically say you have a legal duty to get the best teacher, or at least to get a good teacher and a qualified teacher. And how many North Carolina people do we have here? How many are familiar with Leandro versus State? Anybody? One of the most important education cases in North Carolina jurisprudence affecting the public school system. And I don't know if you've heard of Judge Manning, but our state Supreme case started out in 1994, the year I got into education law. It took 3 years for the first decision in the North Carolina Supreme Court. The question is whether public school students have any kind of qualitative right to an education, not just access to public schools. And the court for the first time said there's a qualitative constitutional right of access. And they said it's called a sound basic education. All students have the right to a sound basic education. And that's in North Carolina. My point is we're seeing this evolution to legal duty. They went on to say the case is still going on, by the way, after millions of dollars have been spent litigating this, and only a small group of people have had their rights resolved, which I guess the application is this is what legal conflicts can do to a school and to resources. So that this is why we want you to stay out of the courts. Even if you've got a winning case, you want to do anything you can to stay out of the courts. But as it's evolved, the court has gone even further and said a sound basic education requires a whole slew of things. It requires passing a certain level on the state testing system, we'll call it level 3, and it requires that every classroom and every school be taught and led by a competent teacher and administrator. Now, I know this doesn't directly pertain to you, but I want you to be aware of this growing legal duty and at least make you sympathetic to your counterparts in the public school system. Back to five, groups of five. Five major trouble spots in this area of law. And I've used typical statements that are described to me when I get a question. The first is, what did you say? Meaning, what did you tell that prospective employer about my past job performance at your school? I want to know. Did you undermine my prospects? And the issue is, what can you tell somebody if you're getting the call, and what can you expect to receive if you're making the call? And at least know what the law allows you to say. So what does the law allow you to say? And don't say it depends. What does the law say regarding employment reference checks in terms of giving out details about a person's job performance if that person, you supervise that person? Does anybody? And this applies across the board, not just to public schools. Yes. Pardon me? Okay. The law allows you to ask that question and to answer it? Yes. What's the general rule? If you look on your outline, you can... Truth. So the common practice is, again, we go back to strategic compliance and motives for compliance. The common practice is not to give out that information. And legally, you don't have to. So why risk a lawsuit for defamation if the law doesn't compel you to disclose to that prospective employer what happened? So you don't have to do it. So why do it? It's ethical? What's that?
It's ethical. You
have a
problem with it.
Okay. Yeah. This is one of those areas where I come back to the golden rule. I mean, even with public school and secular audiences, it's the ethical thing, it's the right thing to do under the right circumstances. If that person perhaps poses a threat academically but many school systems, many attorneys advise their clients to not give out any of that information. Just say, we're not authorized to discuss it. And one of the main duties of a lawyer is to keep your client out of court, and so that's the safe thing to do. So here's another example of balancing what the law allows you to do. Do you max that and say, I'm not going to do it if the law doesn't make me do it? Or is there a right thing to do? And believe it or not, the law protects you doing the right thing. So if you tell the truth, and you got to use your discretion. You also have to care about the person you're talking about. How do I treat that neighbor? What's proper for me to disclose about that person? What kind of dirt because that person has the right to your concern. And I think the basic rule is, well, the legal rule is truth is an absolute defense. And even if you make a good faith mistake and disclose some false information that prevents that person getting a job, if you did it in good faith, you didn't do it maliciously or intentionally, and you couldn't reasonably know you were making a mistake, the law even normally in most states protects you there. So you can do it, and ethically, I hope we would agree that you should do it under the right circumstances. And how much detail you disclose would also be guided by prudence and concern. Yes. When would a school be subject to a negligent hiring claim for failing to do a proper reference check? That's another big problem here. I'm glad you brought that up. Normally, you use the term negligent hiring, right? So the answer would be when you've acted negligently. You had the answer already. And it's like, remember I mentioned with breach of fiduciary duty, it's the same kind of analysis in that you're judging what was reasonable under the circumstances. So if, you know, there's some obvious cases at both ends of the extremes. If you checked every reference, but the references didn't give you true information or what else could you do? You relied on those. You'd be protected. There is a question whether you can be sued for giving out false information. And you can be and probably lose it if it was false, as opposed to not giving out information. So that's one. At the other end of the extreme, which extreme was I at? Giving out false information or checking the references. And then the other extreme would be checking no references. Or doing a criminal record check. Now, you're not required by law to do a criminal record check, so you probably wouldn't be liable there unless you had a very clear board policy that says we'll do record checks. That's where a policy can actually get you into legal trouble. Not that you shouldn't have it, but if you fail to comply with your policies, you may have established a duty, even though the law doesn't establish a duty. We have a famous case in North Carolina where a school system hired someone who allegedly molested a fourth grade student by calling her into his office as a principal and allegedly sexually molesting her during those visits. And it was a negligent hiring and supervision claim. Apparently, there were rumors in the previous system where he worked that he had engaged in inappropriate sexual misconduct. They investigated. They never determined yes or no, but the superintendent met with him, and he neither confirmed nor denied it, but he submitted his resignation and went on. And reading between the lines, they struck a deal. And the deal was, is that what you'd call a Faustian bargain, a bargain with the devil? We won't say anything about this investigation if you'll leave. And I have real ethical problems with that kind of legal advice in most situations, yeah. There's probably no liability if they didn't affirmatively disclose questionable conduct or even actual conduct to the prospective employee. There's no, in our state, in North Carolina, now you'd have to check, there's no affirmative duty to disclose that kind of information to the prospective employer. There may be a state statute or rule that says you have to report to state or local authorities if there's a violation. If you fail to do that, there would be liability. But simply failing to disclose to a prospective employer someone who is a threat and there was no statutory or other legal duty to actually report it to anybody, there's probably no liability. Unless you gave out false information, said the person was a fine teacher, and, you know, we never had any problem. If you disclose false information, there might be a fraud claim. But if you disclose no information... There's an important distinction between being protected if you tell the truth versus being legally obligated to tell the truth or to say, to affirmatively disclose something. What I was saying was that you don't have a duty, the former employer doesn't have any duty to disclose negative information to a prospective employer. However, you should do it ethically because the law protects you if you tell the truth. In other words, if you get sued by that former employee for telling the truth, you're protected against liability. But again, you're not obligated to do it. Does that make sense? You may not like the law. I'm just delivering the news. I didn't make it. Yeah.
My question kind of goes more to contracts, employment contracts and contracts for tuition and things of that nature. Most of the ACCF schools are small, you know, and even though they do the right thing, you still get sued and end up having to spend the money that you have on attorneys.
Yeah.
With regards to tuition contract, at our school we have implemented our mediation and arbitration law where any disputes about tuition are arbitrated before a Christian mediation or arbitration company. Have you seen any schools using that? Has it been successful? Has it been problematic?
I review a lot of contracts that have mandatory mediation in them. There are pros and cons to doing that. And this is actually, it was a point on my outline, so thank you for getting to it. I won't have to. The question is, what about arbitration or some sort of alternative dispute resolution clause in the employment contract? Pros and cons. How often do I see them? I see them a lot. And sometimes I think it makes perfect sense if you're confident that you're not going to be stuck with an arbitrator's decision that you totally disagree with. Now, some have an appeal. You can still appeal to the courts from that. I mean, you can write them in different ways. I think it makes... Generally, it makes sense to have some kind of alternative dispute resolution clause in there. This is one of those areas I'd say get an attorney to advise you through. So don't just go on the internet and look for boilerplate clauses if you can, because they can really come back to bite you, but they can really be beneficial mechanisms to avoid the costs and trouble of going to court. I have a charter school that puts a great deal of value in its mission and values. This is a good example of integration of school values with legal compliance. Puts a great deal of value on sort of civil coexistence and working things out. And they've bound themselves to some external mediation agency to resolve all kinds of disputes. Against my advice, I mean, because there are certain things that you should allow for that to happen, but lots of minutiae and minor decisions, you should cut it off and say the decision's final with the administrator or with the board. So that's an example of, you know, it could be, I think, harmful. So generally, I think it's a good practice if it's properly done and you limit its application. But in, you know, employment contracts, I think it can make perfect sense to have a provision in that to stay out of the courts. Yeah, and if the person just goes straight to the courts normally are going to say you're breaching the contract by going to the court, and the courts are going to enforce that. So that'll save you. You may still have to hire a lawyer to file something in the court, but they'll kick it out and dismiss the suit. Yeah.
One caution, based on the last few weeks of personal experience, I always kind of thought of mediation as being a one-man court judge determining right and wrong. But what I found out, mediation was the median. He took the claim here, the claim here, and he worked for about 12 hours.
And just split the baby.
There was no discussion of right and wrong.
Yeah.
It was just like, are you ready to go to court for this? Do you realize how long it's going to take? And this kind of thing. So it was just finding a happy medium, not a happy.
Yeah, an unsatisfying.
The claim was, the best mediation is when both parties go away mad. So don't think of mediation as being a sort of one-man, independent judge.
Well, that's a great example of ending up with kind of result that's you may want to avoid. Now it may be desirable even to have that kind of result where you're not really very satisfied with it, you're only partially satisfied, but at least you saved a lot of money by not going to court. But, you know, it may not be a good idea. I do want to go back to the negligent hiring question and finish my story. Which was the subsequent school system that hired this alleged molester was sued for negligent hiring and supervision, and the court ruled in their favor, in the school system's favor, because that system didn't do a perfect job of checking references, but they were able to get through to two of the three references, and they gave positive references. And later, when they promoted this guy to the principalship, they actually visited the former superintendent. Unfortunately, didn't ask all the probing questions, just said, has this person ever had problems with homosexual relationships? Because that rumor had come up. So they focused just on that. And the superintendent said, nope, and didn't volunteer anything else. So in that's a situation where a court says, you acted reasonably. You didn't act perfectly. And you could have done more, but you met that threshold reasonableness standard. Yeah.
You can actually ask the question.
Well, this wasn't in this day and age. That wasn't in this day. It was in the 1990. You need to be careful about asking that kind of question. I would rephrase the question. Yeah.
There's a question about the state declared that education is inherently secular and all these options of school will let
it. Yeah. And the state of the law is a little bit in flux right now with that. Many courts are upholding parochial school standards. I've seen some cases recently where they're still upholding the conduct standards because the private school has the right to say what kind of employees. And I think this is a guess. Generally, the conduct standards trump what we would, in other circumstances, say might be discriminatory in these gray areas. Now, obviously, if you discriminate against somebody because of their racial status, because you're in a school that's radically anti-minority or whatever it is, you're going to end up in trouble. Okay, our time is before you bolt for the door. I've got 2 minutes left. All right, so I'm going to, I think most of the things are self-explanatory. Let me just quickly touch on some things. Make the big problems with clarifying job status and security. Lots of contracts or agreement letters have inconsistent clauses. You're employed at will. We're glad to have you for the school year. That's a term contract versus at will. And this happens a lot. So you need to review your employment contracts. You've probably heard of a lot of overtime litigation, failing to pay overtime to people who, quote-unquote, volunteered, employees who volunteered to do other things. They got disgruntled. They hired the attorneys who were making big bundles of money on this litigation. And many school systems, I don't know about the private school context, have been subject to a lot of damages for not paying overtime in situations like that. And then you also have to check your record keeping, your timekeeping. You know, there's the wonderful secretary who comes in half an hour before school starts, before the official day, turns on the coffee, cleans up the office, et cetera, or stays after work, comes in on the weekends, maybe volunteers for the PTA meeting. You may be running afoul of the wage and hour requirements if you're not paying overtime like that, and you need to be rigid and say to your people who are subject to that law, no overtime unless you get it approved and it's documented. So you need to have a clear-cut overtime policy. Grievance procedures are often very mushy, absent, contradictory, confusing. So that's another trouble area. I'm going to bypass student safety and just take questions afterwards. I do want to point out that with respect to those waiver release of liability forms that you issue, and maybe you think, whew, we're covered. Had an accident, we're covered. Uncertain predictability as to whether those will be upheld, again, depending on the circumstances. If you're basically, if there's harm that comes as an extension of something you inherently do as a school, you're probably not protected. Now, if it's sports or if it's an extracurricular voluntary activity and person goes in fully informed of the dangers and signs that, that's a different issue. So it's another example of we better get our attorney to review this and make sure we're using it in the right circumstances. All right, I'm going to wrap up with five concluding points. I think we've had some good Q&A, so I'll bypass that and stick around afterwards. Again, five things to think about doing, making sure you're doing well. Do you have a legal compliance committee or somebody who's thinking about this stuff and making sure there's a system in place? If not, bring it to the table for the board to talk about. Secondly, I recommend some kind of rotational basis for reviewing your legal documents, your employment contracts, your vendor contracts. I've had a number of vendor contract issues come up. You know, these vendors come in, they give you a form contract, and most people just sign them. And there's all kinds of garbage in those. You have to be very careful. And oftentimes your contracts, if you don't review them on this rotational basis, they get out of sync with changes at your school, changes in the law, et cetera, changes in values. So I suggest a rotational review, ideally every 3 years, each kind of policy and handbook and legal document, whether it's a letter, gets reviewed by the legal compliance committee or you have your attorney do that, but making sure that's taken care of. I know it's more time. You're thinking, when do I have time to do this? When do we have time to do this? A fully mature school will do this kind of thing. You may not be able to do it now if you're new. This whole session, I was asked to talk about the role of legal counsel for this whole topic, for this whole one-hour session. And I said, I think they might find that a little boring. I've saved it for this one sub-point. The ideal is to have education attorney who's on your board or who's a parent at your school who just says, yeah, I've got time to do all this, and you don't have to pay the legal fees. That's usually not the case. Usually there is an attorney on the board but doesn't practice in this area. And that's okay for some questions. But the ideal would be to have an attorney, preferably, maybe I'm sounding biased here, someone who knows this stuff, because there are very distinct rules with schools that you can just call. And there are retainer agreements that would allow you to do that, and you don't have to worry about if I'm paying an hourly fee or not, because that can discourage making that call. So I was going to say more about it. I'll just say simply, think about, I mean, you hire people for all kinds of functions at your school. Does it not make sense to have a lawyer retained if you can work out a reasonable deal, if you don't have someone who can do that for you. So consider that. And I tell you, I think it'll pay off. And I've listed some resources there. And then my last point is hopefully just a comforting principle that even if you don't know all the laws, you know, if you act diligently and reasonably, if you act with the right motive, you act with good faith, common sense, and if you follow the golden rule, you're gonna avoid liability and conflicts a good percentage of the time, not every time. But that should hopefully provide you with some comfort. And knowing that the law generally protects you if you act reasonably, with some exceptions, should do you fine. So it's a little bit past my time, so I feel obligated to say thanks for being here. I wish you well. Feel free to come up. And I wish you God's blessing.